Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the former Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. Currently, he's the Executive Director of Public Lands Media. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on welfare, on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently, Protecting the Wild. So as always, George, thank you for your work in the world and thank you for being in the program.
I appreciate you having me on.
So today, let's talk about the move toward allowing e-bikes into more protected areas. So first off, can you say what protected areas, what the policy is, the effects of bikes on these areas, and the effects of e-bikes on these areas?
Sure. Sort of what prompted all this is a recent decision by the Secretary of Interior to open up national parks and by extension BLM lands too, since they're under the Interior, Bureau of Land Management lands, but in particular national park trails and roads that are open up to any kind of biking, current biking, regular sort of, you might say, pedal bikes, would be open up to e-bikes, which e-bike stands for electronic bikes, electronically assisted bikes. And this was done, part of the problem was it was done without any kind of public input and apparently without any input from the agencies themselves. Just what they decided, and then the directive was given to the those agencies to start opening up these trails unless they reason not to. There's a little bit of a, you know, if they were an endangered species or something like that that might be impacted, they could say, well, we're not going to do that. But the general gist of the proposal is to open up these areas to the electronic bikes. And now there are many people who are concerned about just regular biking, particularly mountain biking, you know, bicycles, road bikes like you use on a highway or street, the impacts of mountain biking on both wildlands and wildlife, as well as other public lands users. And the e-bikes, because they can facilitate travel further and faster than even the current mountain bike versions, it poses an even greater threat to those values. And if you give me a moment, I'll articulate some of the issues. One, e-bikes can go 20 to 25 miles per hour or faster, I guess, downhill, but on the level. So you can cover a tremendous amount of distance in a short period of time. And that means that if there's any impacts associated with biking, which there are, you increase the likelihood of those impacts occurring because you can travel further distances. So one of the problems of both mountain bikes as well as e-bikes is that they shrink the conservation value of our lands. And there's a sort of a inverse relationship to access and impacts, so that if you're on foot, for example, I'm a pretty fit hiker, but, you know, with a backpack on, if I can go, you know, 15, 16 miles in a day, it's a pretty tough day for me. And you know, some of the, I know the guys that have the real lightweight gear and stuff like that can walk 25, 30 miles in a day, but nevertheless, you know, the average person 15 miles is going to be a pretty good day. On an e-bike that goes 5 miles an hour, you can cover that same distance in 1 hour. And even a regular mountain bike, you know, they go 10 miles an hour or more without too much trouble, the average riding one, because of the gears and so forth. So, you can easily see where something like, let's say a park or a wilderness area, one of the ways that the work to the benefit of wildlife, particularly sensitive wildlife, is that humans are both unable to penetrate the areas that are particularly large very readily. And the number of people who will penetrate it is significantly smaller than, you know, what the overall numbers might be. In other words, what I mean by that is, let's say you have an area that's 30 miles across. As I said, you know, somebody who's reasonably fit might be able to do cross that in 2 days. That's the people that are going to try to go out for a period of time. An average day hiker wouldn't even get halfway across. So what that means is that when you're 15 or 20 miles in, wherever that might be, that very few humans get into that area, and therefore there's less disruption to sensitive wildlife, like everything from wolverine and bears to even elk and deer can be impacted. And then, whereas with the mechanical advantage of bikes, you can go much further. The other part of the equation is not just the distance traveled, but the there appears to be, at least in some research that's out there, to be an adverse effect from mountain bikes and other mechanical ATVs, dirt bikes, whatever, e-bikes, which are just sort of anymore an electronic dirt bike. There seems to be a greater sensitivity of wildlife to their presence. In other words, where an elk might run from a hiker at, say, 500 feet distance, they'll run from a mountain bike as much as 1,600 feet away from the bike. And nobody really knows why that is, although one reason I've heard is that the speed of which a mountain bike or dirt bike or whatever is moving triggers a reaction in things like elk, because what they are on the lookout for is fast moving things like cougars and wolves and so forth. And so when anything sort of flashes by quickly, they have a negative response and reaction. In any event, whatever the reason is, even using the same trails, the mechanical advantage has a wider impact on many species. And the impact is not just on the immediate use of that area. If it's continuously used by humans, the animals learn to avoid those areas. And so you might have otherwise good habitat, but you might have a half a mile to a mile area on either side of, say, a trail that we'll use something like a grizzly bear that might avoid that area. And in most mountain valleys, you know, the bottom of the valley is usually only about a mile to two across. So a trail that might get a lot of mountain bike use might effectively eliminate that habitat, even if it's good habitat, from use by grizzly bears. And you multiply that cumulative impact over many areas, you start shrinking the security habitat and the habitat available to those species. There's another factor that also is problematic that has to do with the travel effects of mountain bikes, e-bikes, or whatever, or human users of the area too. And I'm not saying that that's my greatest concern, but it's still a problem for a lot of people to be walking down a trail and be constantly looking over their shoulders to see if somebody is speeding towards them on a bike. And that sort of anxiety and angst can take away from their, you know, paying attention to the nature around them. If you're always watching for something over your shoulder, you're not going to notice maybe the birds in the trees or the other reasons why you're out there for a walk in the woods. So it can negatively impact the human users in that. And there's another aspect of it that's hard to quantify, but there's plenty of people that can document that it does occur, and that is there's a tendency among mountain bike users in particular, and it also used to be very common in ATV, dirt bikers, etc., to create what we call illegal trails. And it's a very common thing for mountain bikers to just decide they want a trail someplace, and without consulting the public lands agency in charge, whether it's a state park or the Bureau of Land Management or a national forest ranger district, without any kind of consultation, they just build the trail. And this is a very common problem because, you know, there's sight of these trails. There's no looking at the cumulative impacts of more and more trail miles. There's, you know, maybe the trail goes through an elk winter range. I mean, there's lots of reasons why trails built willy-nilly couldn't be problematic. And this is very, very common with that group. You don't see bird watchers going out building a lot of illegal trails. So it's a very common subset of public land users that tend to be part of this. And you can see this in the websites and other information you might get from mountain bike organizations. It's almost all about building trails. And it's actually, in my mind, a situation of the consumer society of more, more, more. We never have enough. We need more, more, more. And that applies to the trails, too. For whatever reason, a lot of mountain bikers, I don't want to say all of them, but a lot of them are not content with the same trail over and over again. So they want to see more and more trails, and a lot of them are built without any kind of supervision or oversight. So that's the problematic thing, too. Once you get, it's a lot easier, I guess the way to step back, it's a lot easier to prevent illegal trails from being created if no bikes, whether it's an e-bike or a regular traditional pedal bike, are allowed in that area, than to try to allow them on certain trails and then try to keep them from creating more trails and loops and so forth from those areas. It's very difficult for the managing agency to supervise that use and manage that use. They're not equipped for it. They don't have a stomach for it in many cases. And they don't have the funding to do the monitoring and so forth. And so what happens is we see a greatly expanded trail system being created in many places that have detrimental effect, as I said, on the wildlife and other public lands users in that area. And it's I think the e-bike decision was actually done partly on purpose by the Trump administration, because there is a knowledge in the Trump administration that there's a substantial, very active mountain biking community that wants to open up parks and wilderness areas to their use by bikes. For example, a lot of people may not know this, but designated wilderness mechanical access is prohibited, and mechanical includes mountain bikes. So there is a real constituency of the more aggressive mountain bikers, I would say, that see trails in wilderness and parks open to their use. And this is the other threat that I see from it, creation of more trails and use in areas that are proposed for parks and wilderness. And particularly if you're being very strategic about this, as I think the Trump administration is, and maybe I'm giving more credit than they deserve, but nevertheless, if you build a constituency of people who want or are mountain biking area that's proposed for wilderness, you will probably have opposition to that wilderness designation. And so what you often see is the mountain bikers joining with the ORV crowd, the snowmobilers, the dirt bikers, etc. They join and in unison oppose wilderness and other protective status for landscapes because they see it as affecting their use of that landscape for their own recreation.
Excuse me. Thank you for that. And there's a couple more things I would like to talk about with paths before we before we move on. One of them is small creatures and the effects of biking on newts, salamanders, as opposed to foot traffic.
Right.
Go ahead.
Well, I ride a bike on gravel roads and stuff, and just recently almost ran over two snakes while I was biking. And to get to your point, because I'm going faster than somebody on foot, I saw the snakes at the last minute. They kind of look like sticks on the road. I was only able to avoid them, luckily. And, it's kind of like the same thing that, the faster your speed, just like driving a car, you hit birds once in a while too, that are flying through the air. And it just, at least on those pathways that are being used a lot by bikes, that you will, avoid killing some of those and hurting some of those animals is impossible to argue, because it just the speed you're going at and makes it likely that you will see these things because they're small at the last minute and have a difficult time avoiding having a collision. Whereas if you're on foot, you are going at a pace that allows you to things and avoid having the impact. So I think you're absolutely right. The smaller animals too can be impacted greatly by the bikes. And again, it's the speed factor. As we up the speed, our ability to avoid collisions goes down. And another thing I haven't mentioned about the speed factor, and I think it's important, and I know this to be a fact because I ride bikes myself, is that you have to be paying attention, particularly if you're not on pavement, on any gravel road or a trail. You have to be paying attention constantly to what's right in front of you. You take your eyes off of that trail for a second, and you hit a rock the wrong way or whatever, you're going to have a crash. I know there are advocates of mountain biking who say they're out there to enjoy nature and to sort of commiserate with the natural world, but I just don't believe them because I know in my own experience, I'm paying attention to what's right in front of me. I don't even notice what the landscape I'm going through or what's out there. And in fact, it inhibits my ability to have any kind of, communication or appreciation of the natural world. I might be able to say, well, it was a nice sunny day and I enjoyed outdoors because I'm breathing clean air. I mean, that kind of thing, certainly. But in terms of really noticing the landscape you're in and paying attention, the speed you're going at and the need to pay attention to what's right in front of you really inhibits, I think, that kind of appreciation of the natural world that hopefully we're trying to foster people.
And even if people, even those small creatures who are not immediately killed, there's another problem here, which is that I've read that there are many species of insects, for example, beetles, who won't cross open spaces larger than 4 or 5 feet. And so if you have a tiny little path, maybe they can cross, but if you have a larger path than that, you've fragmented the habitat.
Well, that's definitely true, and it's also true in the sense of a lot of the, at least in the places I'm familiar with, like in the Northern Rockies and Montana and Idaho and so forth, a lot of the illegal mountain bike trails that are created are often following game trails. That's what they, start out as. Somebody's riding along and they see a trail created by the deer and the elk and they say, this looks like go on it. And so you eliminate that trail for use by the elk and the deer because they, if they have the amount of use, they avoid those areas. So yeah, and every one of those new trails fragments the habitat. When I was talking about illegal trails, I'll just give you one example from Montana. There's a place that I like to go for walks frequently, near Livingston, and it's a trail that goes up into the Absaroka Beartooth Wilderness. And recently this summer, I found that there was a new illegally created mountain bike trail that paralleled, not real closely, but paralleled the existing hiking trail and shortened out a bunch of switchbacks and so forth. So now there's a new trail there with the existing trail, and even the existing trail, my presence hiking can have an impact. But now you have two impacts, and the habitat in between those two trails is less suitable for the wildlife in the area. And you know, by constantly expanding trail systems with no regard to how that impacts wildlife and the landscape, I think is one of the big problems. And I don't know how much of a problem this is, but I'm going to mention it too. The spread of weeds and other things can be accompanied by the bikes as well, and that has to do with the fact that, you know, you might get seeds in the mud of a bike from one place, and you go to another place and you ride there and you get the seeds there. And of course, mountain bikers would say to me, well, you know, you can have seeds in your shoes and do it too, and it's true. The difference is that the mountain bikes, again, will travel a much greater area, so the ability to inoculate an area with weeds in places that would otherwise not have weeds is much greater.
And also, not just weeds, but also, that's a big deal where I live, Port Orford cedar root rot. So it can be not just seeds that you might be able to see, but also pathogens that you couldn't see anyway.
That's a good one, and that's a real problem with the logging roads, as you know, and the logging equipment taking that disease that kills the Port Orford cedar. Yeah, and that can happen any place. And so, again, it's one of those things, you're just adding to the weight of impacts on the land and on the wildlife, and at some point it breaks the land. And, you know, and this is another argument you will get from mountain bikers and e-bikers and the ORV crowd and so forth too. They'll say, well, you know, horses, which are allowed in wilderness, do a lot of damage to trail, which is absolutely true. But my response to them is that doesn't mean just because there is an existing impact, we need to expand those impacts with new impacts, which is what the mountain bikes introduce. And, so there's, you know, you can't just say because there's one bad thing, other new bad things should be okay. And I think that I don't buy that argument.
Well, it's crazy. It's crazy. It's like if you go into the hospital and they say you have a staph infection, so let's go ahead and infect you with MRSA. I mean, it's complete nonsense. Yeah. Or I'm sorry, you know, right now your family, you have big medical bills, and that's trouble. So hey, let's go ahead and buy a new car. You know, that's just one more expense that's going to drive you down. It's nuts. Yeah. And in no other area except environmental issues is this recognized as an argument.
Exactly true. And you know, I don't know what the correct overview term to use for it, but let me just describe the situation. You know, I did this book on thrillcraft, which at the time we decided not to include mountain bikes as part of it, although we had a big debate about whether we should or shouldn't. But one of the things I did for that book, which was focused on motorized recreation like snowmobiles and dirt bikes and ATVs and that sort of thing, or any kind of off-highway vehicle, we looked at the ads that are used in advertisement. And the ads tell you a lot about who they're trying to appeal to and the uses that they think are legitimate. And these ads overwhelmingly use terms like brute force, you know, conquer nature, you know, tear up the land. You know, they were advertisements about domination, control. And if you look at mountain bike ads, they have a lot of similarities. They say, you know, you'll go faster, you'll cover more ground, you'll control, you know, the land more. And they're appealing to the same kind of mindset, the conquer nature mindset. And it's different. If you look at ads for, I don't know, bird watching binoculars or something, it's not about, oh, well, go out and conquer nature. You know, it's usually some picture of serene landscape and somebody there looking at birds or a camping ad or something like that. It's much more about contemplative kind of approach to nature. And the mountain bike ads, which again are focused on the more aggressive people, I'm quick to say there's a lot of people that just ride mountain bikes kind of haphazardly and, you know, just it's an easy way to get outside and get some exercise. But they're not the ones that are pushing the boundaries. They're not the people that are trying to create new trails everywhere and keep a wilderness from being designated and so forth. And the ads are directed towards those kinds of people. And so it tells you a lot about the way the advertisers obviously know who they're appealing to. They wouldn't be using ads like that if they didn't think they were effective. And it says, I think, a great deal about the general approach to mountain biking and and why people ride mountain bikes. It's all of it is to be able to say, I conquered that trail or I rode this distance and look at me. And a lot of them are too. There's another thing about mountain bikers, and there's a lot of it's about being able to get back to the brew pub for a beer by the end of the day, so you can tell all your buddies about, you know, the trail you rode and how far you rode. So there's a lot of ego stuff in it, is I guess what I'm saying.
Well, and this is something I think we've discussed a little bit before, that it horrifies me that the lives of the health, the ecological health is weighed against what are effectively toys for adults. And I think about that with the ORV stuff all the time, that I don't even understand how this is a discussion, because I mean, I remember a neighbor kid had a mini bike when I was a kid, and that was fun to play on, but I mean, it's like an amusement park ride. It's
right.
and that's fine, but it strikes me as, honestly, I'm going to use a pretty bad word here. It strikes me as pretty pathetic when you have adults who are arguing that it's okay to harm a land base so that they can play with a toy.
Well, that was a term that we threw out, Kraft. We coined the phrase amusement parks.
Yeah.
Amusement parks. And to be honest, particularly, you know, when I've talked to some of the serious mountain bikers, they truly believe they're not having an impact, or their argument is, well, these other things have an impact, so, you know, why can't I have an impact? In other words, the horses on the trail or whatever it might be. But it still is ignoring the fact that there's a cumulative impact that's greater than these other uses. And also, as we mentioned earlier, just because there's an end-user group doesn't mean that we need to add to that greatly. And there's a sort of a sense that I get of entitlement that is very common in the things I read by mountain bikers and I've heard, not in debates with some, that there's a sense of land, so therefore I should have a right to use it and without restrictions or limitations. And there, that's that sort of sense of entitlement, I think, is part of the problem, that's why there is not the sense of a regret or an admission that if I make another 10 miles of trail here illegally, I'm doing anything wrong. It's actually in the mind of many of those people that are doing that, that they're doing a public benefit, actually. And they're convinced that they're making the land more accessible to more people. And in and of itself is a good. And this is the tricky part for me, because I have you know, there's a part of me that really feels like it's, you know, you want to get people in the outdoors and experience the natural world. And I think that's how you get proponents of the natural world. And that's how you get people to have empathy for wildlife and have an understanding of ecosystems. And so, you know, part of me is really being an advocate of getting people in the natural world. On the other hand, how you get into the natural world, I think, does affect your perception of it and how you relate to it. And the more mechanical things, again, not just mountain bikes, but, you know, RVs, motorboats, any of that, jet skis, the whole thing, insulate you from that sort of experience in a way that reduces that empathy, and it reduces the ability to understand the natural world as much as you would if you went slower and looked around a little bit more. So, you know, on one hand, the mountain bikers will say, well, you're against people, because that's what they'll say to me. They'll say I'm against people because I say I think that mountain bikes should be very restricted on where they're allowed on public lands. And at the same time, you know, that's certainly not how I feel about it. Although, you know, I'm quite willing to argue that there should be places that maybe few or any people go to. A lot of that happens naturally, of course, because there's a lot of places where there's no trails and those places get very few humans at them. And there's some that are legally designated. Yellowstone Park is a good example of that. There are large areas of Yellowstone Park that are off limits to you and I to hike in, and that's fine with me. Some of them are seasonal closures, some of them are year-round, but there's some big areas in Yellowstone that they set aside for grizzly bears and other wildlife, so they are not disturbed by the human impacts. And probably if the managers of the park could start with a clean slate, there are probably a lot of areas of the park that they probably wouldn't have trails in anymore, just for that same reason. So they have to, they're mostly designating places that don't have much in the way of trails as sort of grizzly bear management zones. But the point being, I think that we need to be open to the idea that there should be areas on public land, because we don't have much control on private lands, but public lands that we just say, you know, this is for the wildlife, this is for the ecological processes, this is, you know, recreation and access doesn't have to happen everywhere. And we need to recognize that we have an impact, and we need to minimize our impact. And mountain biking needs more restrictions than other kinds of recreational use, because it can have a greater impact. You know, in the days when we were all riding horses, you didn't need stoplights and speed limits. Well, you know, you get cars and you need stoplights and speed limits and restrictions. And it's the same thing with any kind of mechanical advantage. And that's why saying that a mountain bike should be allowed every place that's got a trail where anybody can hike, I think, is an inappropriate response. We need more restrictions on that mechanical access beyond whether it's a wilderness area or not.
Given that humans are one species out of millions, I think I'd be willing to compromise and make it so the rest of the species only get, I don't know, what, 50% of the planet? 70%? But leaving that aside, I wanna go to, I grew up in Colorado, and I spent a lot of time up in the high country, and there were places where I saw wagon tracks that were made in the 1870s that had not recovered in the tundra, in the alpine tundra. And so can you talk for a minute about, we've been talking a lot about paths, can you talk about the recovery? So that's the bad news. The good news is, where I live, there's a path between my mom's house and my house that was a road when I moved in. And over the last 20 years, it has, some of it you can still see where there was a road, but some of it has collapsed down to the size of one person walking, which is me. So can you talk about trail recovery, both in fecund habitat. So let's say you've got a, they put in an illegal trail, and what's sort of a best case scenario for that trail if it gets closed off, recovering, and what's a worst case scenario?
Okay, well, let me start that. That's a good question. Let me start that with a little bit of the science on trail creation, which is, and it's kind of surprising, and that is, it doesn't take very many users to create a trail. In other words,
I want to say one thing real quick, which is, yeah. I walk by myself, and I also sometimes push a wheelbarrow, and that is enough to kill. It's amazing that only one person a day, two paths, you know, coming up once and coming down once, plus an occasional wheelbarrow, that is enough to keep part of the trail open. That's it. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, my point is that, you know, you don't have to have 100 bikes go by to initiate a trail creation. And that's one of the surprising things. It's a very, in most kinds of landscapes, it takes very little initial use to create a trail. Now, and then of course, once the trail's in place, more people use it. And the, to get to your point about sensitive landscapes, and what we find, of course, is that the landscapes that are in harsher environments, whether that's desert, whether it's alpine, etc., are the ones that are particularly vulnerable to long-lasting impacts from any kind of use. And that's because of the growth is so slow in those places of plants, and they're on the margins to begin with, so any impact has a greater effect. And there are other effects that are not necessarily visible, and that's soil compaction and things like that that inhibit both the water, increases water runoff, for example, so therefore more likely to have erosion of the trail. And then there's also the ability of plants to get established in something that has a lot of compaction, soil compaction, and it's harder for them to get their roots down into it, so that inhibits the recovery as well. The real issue to me is that there, as you're sort of hinting at, I think, is that there are some places that are totally so sensitive that just the plant communities themselves, forget about the wildlife that might be impacted, that use of any kind of mechanical access can create long-lasting scars on the landscape that have ecological consequences, for example, as I mentioned, more severe erosion because of runoff.
Yeah, and I remember places in Colorado where there would be signs saying, don't even walk on this because it's not used to having large animals there, you know, way, way up in the mountains.
Well, you know, the other place too is in the desert areas where there's the biocrust or cryptogamic crusts that cover the landscape that are very sensitive to any disturbance. Of course, the biggest disturbance factor in a lot of that country is from livestock production, cattle. But the disturbance can be from humans as well, and perhaps a certain limited amount of access on a trail. If everybody stays on the trail, you know, you can say, well, it's not that big a deal. But that's where I say the problem of creation of new trails that spreads out from an existing trail is much more likely with some of these land users than others. And what happens when the cryptogamic crusts are disturbed, whether it's from livestock, whether it's from hikers, whether it's from mountain bikers, is that you get more wind and water erosion. You get more likely to get things like cheatgrass, which is an exotic plant, alien plant from Asia that's very fire prone to be established on the landscape. So you really do weaken the resilience of that landscape. And disturbance of any of those crusts and desert areas can have a long-lasting impact, and the more trails you have and the more use, the more likely you are to have that disturbance. Again, I want to hasten to say that livestock is probably the biggest problem, because even the mountain bikers sort of stay on trails to a degree, and the cattle go all over the place. So they're having impacts everywhere.
So we have about 6 or 7 minutes left, and two things. One of them, I'll ask the first thing, and then I'll ask the second thing in a minute. First thing is, you've said this some, but can you really sort of just lay out one more time? The new policy is to extend, to allow e-bikes as opposed to just mountain bikes into certain areas. First off, is that correct? And second, can you just lay out one last time why e-bikes are even worse than mountain bikes?
Yes, that is correct. Basically, the announcement is that any trail that is currently open to regular bikes, whether that's a road bike or a mountain bike or anything, and that could be a trail, it could be a road, it could be a dirt road, it will now be open to e-bikes. And initially, it was applied, the announcement came out to apply to national parks, but then subsequently, it's been anything under the Department of Interior, which includes the Bureau of Land Management and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service lands. And the reason why that has a problem is simply that the e-bikes can go faster and go further. And, I'll give you an example. I did a little experiment recently. There's a road up by Bozeman, Montana that I ride my bike on frequently. It's a gravel road, but, you know, it's not open to cars or anything. And a lot of people ride their bikes on it. And so I did this loop and I timed myself, and it took me, about 7 miles per hour average on that loop, riding my bike. And then I borrowed a friend's e-bike and I did the same loop and I did 16 miles per hour on the same terrain. So that demonstrates how much more efficiency the e-bike provided me in terms of travel ability. And that's one of the attractions. I think that e-bikes are, you know, a lot of people that are on mountain bikes, the going uphill is not part of the attraction to them. It's the coming down fast. So I think what you're going to see is a transition here, where more and more people are going to want to use e-bikes because of the ability to travel further and faster, particularly uphill. And we will see more and more use of those bikes on trails. And, and they're very attractive also to older people or people that are physically not in as great a shape. So that's another attraction, and it's being promoted by the mountain bike. We got to step back and say, who's promoting this? Well, it's being promoted by the manufacturers, the bike manufacturers, because they see this is a whole new genre, so to speak, a whole new subset of people that they can sell their product to. So there's a lot of advertisement going into this and a lot of push to get the bikes. And again, I hasten to say, I think it's great for people to ride bikes around town. I think e-bikes are very good in town, although they're kind of dangerous because people can't, they're used to judging the regular speed of a bike, and an e-bike can come up so much faster. But in general, I don't have a problem with people riding e-bikes around town, and it would be preferable to driving in a car. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's appropriate in more natural areas that we're hopefully setting aside for conservation values.
And to your point, there's an article here that has this one line: how is a 65-year-old father supposed to climb the same steep ramps as his trained 33-year-old son? Implying that, that is pretty much stating explicitly that there will be more people in these wild places.
Well, that's exactly it. And that's kind of like saying we should, have helicopter flights at the top of every mountain or a tram or something, just so you can get older people up. I mean, there's a limit to where you have to say that there's a good reason why we should not have mechanical advantage for everybody. And if it's that important to you, do your best to get there. And often there are other alternatives to allow, you to experience natural lands without having to compromise them in this way. So, And, you know, I would say to people that say they want to, you know, the whole thing of getting to the top of a peak, if that's your goal, that's probably not it's not appropriate to compromise the natural world just because you have a, you know, particular interest in having a goal and getting to the top of the mountain or whatever. And maybe you ought to just sit at the bottom of the mountain and contemplate how nice it is to look at the top of the mountain and find, well, you know, appreciation in that experience.
You know, when earlier you said that, you're an advocate for people getting out in wilderness and of course, or out mm-hmm. in nature, and I am too, of course. Mm-hmm. But when I wrote a book against, zoos back in 2004 or whenever it was, one of the arguments in favor of zoos is people need to see wild animals. And my argument in that book was that, well, if you want to see bears, then you should live such that bears want to see you. And if you want to see nature, maybe you should start at home and recognize. And so in that book, I went to, the worst place in town I could think of, which was a McDonald's parking lot. And just a second. Hush! I went to a McDonald's parking lot and looked at the shrubbery around, and there were seagulls, there were bumblebees, there were ants. And my point is, those are nature too. And my real point is, if we want to have a relationship with natural beings, the way to do it is not to invade their territory, force them to run away from their homeland, and then be happy. We saw one bear rump as it ran away as fast as it could.
Right. Yes, that is a certainly a valid point, and I think that you know, there's a validity in saying that the nature is around us, and at the same time, you know, you just have to be open and receptive to seeing it and experiencing it. And I just think that, you know, the faster you go, the less open you are to that kind of experience. And you know, I mean, that's the whole point of driving in cars, for example, and never getting out of your car. You can see a lot, you can cover a lot of miles, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you've had any kind of real interaction with the landscape. You know, I don't know if this is a good analogy or not, but you know, sort of like if you sat on a subway train and nobody talks to anybody and you see a lot of people and say, well, you know, I encountered more people today because I was on the subway. Compare that is good quality of sitting down with a friend, you know, and having, you know, coffee with them and talking to them. I mean, there's a greater intimacy there. It's not just the sheer numbers that's important.
Well, thank you for that. And the last question is, so what, if anything, can people do about this particular issue?
Well, you know, the Park Service, at least people that work in the Park Service and some in the BLM, they're not particularly happy about the way that, you know, partly it came down as an order from above without any kind of discussion. And so they're not particularly happy with how it was implemented. And I think that one of the ways you can push back is both if there is any opportunity to comment, you know, one of the things that they're supposed to do is analyze all the roads and trails and say these are going to be open to e-bikes and which ones won't, is to get involved, of course, and comment on it. And another way is just to simply push back through Congress and try to write your representative and express your displeasure with how this was done and why it's a threat to the overall park or wilderness or public lands that are near you, and try to, you know, say that this has to be done in a much more if the area is going to be, or a particular trail or path is going to be opened to e-bikes or mountain bikes in general, there should be a much greater scrutiny of that proposal, and including an environmental assessment of the impacts, and particularly the cumulative impacts, because what we see over and over again is you can't just look at one trail and say, oh, this trail doesn't have much of an impact if you're having 10 other trails in the same general area. So that's an important point to make, is cumulative impacts.
Well, thank you so much for all of that, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.